This is the second day of this June 2017 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday. It's a book about the teachings of Chinese Zen master Fo Yan from the 12th century. And it's from a book called Instant Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. Here I only require you to practice the way. Your first priority, 24 hours a day, should be to get rid of egotism toward others. Why? Egotism toward others is the business of mediocrities. Egotism toward others. Well, this is not going to be surprising to anyone. We all subscribe to one degree or another to Hakuin's statement that ego is the source of our suffering. How does it play out, this egotism toward others? Well, even in Sesshin, we can name a few ways it plays out. Being noisy or careless in your room would be a way to showing egotism toward others. Now, this might be, one might say, well, this is just a kind of a lack of mindfulness. But what is a lack of mindfulness? It's not being aware of others. Another during Sesshin would be to stock up on cushions that are in some short supply. Like we mentioned in the guidelines, these thin square cushions can be useful to many people, but if someone is using, say, more than three of them, then we ask that they instead use another cushion that is the equivalent of two or three of those cushions, so that the thinner ones will be available to others for fine tuning of the posture. There are also those who don't pitch in moving dividers. Now, there are people who, because of physical limitations, can't do so. Although it would seem that just about anyone could get up and man one of these braces that have to be handled, the braces at the base of the dividers, and call them adopt a brace. To just be while the dividers are being removed or replaced, to be fussing with one's cushions when one could be helping out, or even worse, standing and watching when one is able, physically able, to help out, would be another form of egotism. A lot of egotism, I think, is just lack of awareness, just being too self-absorbed. I'm not saying that I don't know if anyone in this sesshin would be guilty of these things. I'm just thinking of ways in which this can... egotism can show up in sesshin, besides thoughts, of course. Another one that used to happen every once in a while, I don't know if it has happened in the 21st century, was people who would fasten on to certain foods at meals. The one I remember from decades ago was someone who got in their mind that they were going to eat only salads for sesshin. Yeah, just good, clean food. Purify the system, only salad. And they would load up their plate with just salad, and which is all very noble, but if you take more than your portion, more than the kitchen had allotted as an average portion, then others are going to have to go without. And here too, someone might say, well, wait a minute, I'm not having any of the potatoes, let's say. But still, it's taking more than one's share. I guess it's an old thing in human history, taking more than one's share. He continues, people now want to understand theoretically at once, as soon as anything is said. How can you learn the way in this fashion? Sometimes I see beginners come to Doksan helpless to do anything about the fact that they have already seen through them. They are like villagers armed with carrying poles trying to do battle with a general. Here I am, fully equipped. In my hand is the 100-pound sword of a legendary warrior, while they have nothing but a carrying pole. They strike a blow, and, seeing the man not move, they strike several more times and leave. It's not that I fear them, it's because they are no match for me. Ha ha. I urge you not to be crude-minded. In your conduct, day and night, keep evolving higher. Then, even if you do not attain enlightenment, you will still be a highly refined individual. Be sure to be attentive. Well, keep evolving higher is a pretty abstract and vague kind of a directive. So let's make it clear. How do we evolve? Through detaching from thoughts, most of which are about oneself. That's the nature of thoughts. Most of them revolve around the I, the me, or the my. And the less we can dwell in our thoughts, the more we evolve, to use his word or the translator's choice of translation. As soon as you accept and approve anything, recognizing it as your own, you are immediately bound hand and foot and cannot move. So even if there are 1,000 possibilities, nothing is right once you have recognized, accepted, and approved it as your own. I think what he's talking about is identifying with something, making it part of your own ego identity. Translating Chinese is the most difficult thing. It has to be the most difficult thing in the world. The Chinese language is so ambiguous. There are in all kinds of ways. The written characters, which of course is what the translators are working from. The written characters are sometimes written in not just classical Chinese, but a certain where in Chinese, I'm told, the written characters don't distinguish between singular and plural. They're often extremely vague as to references, especially pronoun references. This is what makes koans, which are almost all from China, makes koans so elusive is because there are they're vague in terms of references and all. But then on top of it, so that means that the translator is responsible for the language that we read in English on the page. And I have to say that the Cleary brothers crank out an awful lot of translations, and sometimes they're just difficult to access the English they use. Maybe because their English, the English they use is quite literal. Translators have this decision often of putting down a more literal meaning of the character or their own interpretation, rendering it into more contemporary language, and either one runs a risk. If you do the latter, if you render it into nice contemporary English, then you may be taking liberties that you shouldn't be taking. It wasn't meant that way. But if you do it just literally, then it can be quite vague. I think the Clearys tend to be pretty literal because the language, the English, can be rather confounding. But I would see this as more referring to the human tendency to grasp on to certain concepts and or groups and identify with them and make them your own. That's where he says, recognizing it as your own, you immediately bound hand and foot and cannot move. So we human beings tend to build into our self-identity matters of religion. It's my religion, my opinion, my political party, my gender, my race, my ethnicity. And as soon as we do that, then we are put in a defensive position where we have to defend that, and we limit ourselves to the degree to which we identify with anything other than everything. And it seems to be such a powerful need now. It's a kind of tribalism where people need to find ways to identify themselves in terms of groups and categories, and it incites all kinds of conflict, if only in discourse. He says, it is like making a boat and outfitting it for a long journey to a land of treasures. Then as soon as you are about to get started, you drive a stake in the ground and tie the boat down, then row with all your might. You may row till the end of time, but you will still be at the shore. You see the boat moving from side to side and think you are on the move, but actually you haven't gotten anywhere. That's just a vivid image here, vivid analogy of how we obstruct ourselves when we cling to whatever the I, the me, or the my is. In our case. Now naturally we are part of certain classifications, certain races and gender and so forth, but it doesn't mean we need to cling to those categories in the mind. It's enough just to be in one of these categories without making a lot of it in the mind. Skipping some pages here, he says, in quotation marks, no delusion, no enlightenment. And then he says, only when you have arrived at such a state are you comfortable and saving energy to the maximum degree. but this is simply being someone without delusion or enlightenment. What is there deluding you 24 hours a day? You must apply this to yourself and determine on your own. Now, this is a very advanced state to have seen through these designations of being enlightened or deluded. Here too, in speaking in relative terms, we can say that some of us have awakened to our true nature and others have not, and we can call that enlightenment or delusion. But to here too identify with it, to think to oneself, "I'm unenlightened, I'm deluded," this is unnecessary and just very much creates an impediment to practice. There's no reason to have those thoughts. This phrase of his, saving energy, we run across this over and over in the old Chinese texts, the Chan texts, about saving energy. I don't recall running across it in Japanese Zen texts, but it refers to the vitality energy that we have when we are unshackled from our thoughts, when we're just living out of direct experience. And we all get a taste of this in Sesshin as the Sesshin moves on, and the thoughts that are binding us early in Sesshin tend to loosen and thin out, and then we find ourselves acting, moving, functioning with a sureness and an energy that we don't have normally when our mind is clogged with thoughts. He continues, all realms of existence are there because of the deluded mind. Right now, how could they not be there? Once you realize they are not there, they cannot delude your feelings and certainly cannot do anything to you. It is necessary to attain the reality where there is no delusion and no enlightenment before you can become free and unfettered. So these realms of existence, to realize that they're not there, what does that mean? It means that however you may experience them, there's no unchanging state. Everything is in flux. Hakuin reminds us from the very beginning. No, this is a statement, not Hakuin, although he may have said this, but a fundamental Zen statement is from the very beginning there's never been a single thing. Contrary to everything our ordinary mind tells us, contrary to what our senses tell us, that there's this, and there's this, and yet there's never been a single thing. What in the world does that mean? It can only be understood when grasped experientially. Yes, one can kind of figure it out conceptually, but that's nothing like the direct experience of seeing things fundamentally as no thing. Seeing that what we call enlightenment is a no enlightenment, what we call delusion is a no delusion. These are words, concepts that we all too easily get attached to. We want to free ourselves from these things that really only hinder us. And then skipping a paragraph, he says, think about it independently. Other people do not know what you are doing all the time. You reflect on your own. Are you in harmony with truth or not? Here you cannot be mistaken. Investigate all the way through. There's this word truth. It can be so troublesome, but so tempting to get stuck in. If there's anything that we could call truth, it's direct experience. There's no dogma or doctrine that is really direct experience. All ideas about truth are just ideas. The thing itself is the experience, immediate experience. When we are free of thoughts and just directly experiencing things as they are, we are in harmony with so-called truth. And that's what this practice that each of us is working on, it's what it's all about, is to enable us to detach from the thoughts in the mind and just, when hungry, eat, just eat. When tired, just sleep. When walking, just walk. He says, when my late teacher appeared in the world to teach, he said, I rise from this jewel flower throne and sit upon it every day along with all of you. It is just that you avoid what is right before you. So he's saying, all of us sit on this Buddha throne. All of us. Fundamentally. It's just that you avoid what is right before you. That is, avoid the direct, pure experience of things as they are. Here's one where he says, the Zen school is called the school of Kashyapa's great absorption in quiescence. Without stirring a thread, all is understood. Without stirring a hair, all is realized. He's probably referring here to the story of the Buddha holding up a flower and only Mahakashyapa smiling in response. Buddha holding up the flower. Without stirring a thread, all is understood. All is realized. It's a verse in the Mumonkan, without taking a step, the journey is complete. He says, do not rouse the mind or stir thoughts throughout the 24 hours of the day, and you should be able to comprehend everything. This is called being a member of Kashyapa's school, Chan, Zen. Only then can you enter great absorption and quiescence. Now, what is there that acts as a mental object and an obstruction? Although people can investigate, people can practice, they cannot understand by stirring thoughts. When you encounter a situation or hear a saying, if your thoughts stir, your mind gets excited, and you make up an interpretation, in any case, you are in a scattered state. Yesterday we read Master say, it is not to be found in words, in thoughts. Here's another one. There is something in each of you that will only be able to perceive when you turn around. So how does one turn around? By non-seeking seeking, seeking without seeking. This is precisely what people find hard to deal with or get into. How can you seek if you are not seeking? How can you not seek if you are seeking? If you only seek, how is that different from pursuing sounds and chasing forms or thoughts? If you do not seek at all, how are you different from inert matter? There are other Chinese masters too who say, above all, don't strive. Sometimes it's translated as strive, sometimes it's translated as seek. And this can be a real puzzle to people. I've had many people come and say, what does that mean? I'm here, I have 1 week a year or 2 weeks a year I can devote to this practice in Sesshin. What does it mean, don't strive, don't seek? Well, it certainly doesn't mean to sit, as he said, inertly and wait for things to come to you. But it also doesn't mean grasping at something that you think is outside you. That's what this is the warning here. So how do you neither grasp for something that you imagine is outside you, nor fall into passivity, just waiting for something to happen? You do the practice. You do the practice as best you can, as sincerely as you can. And then, by and by, you find a way to find this sweet spot between where you're neither grasping nor passive. And how, what does that mean? I can't say. You just have to do it. Find it. Work it out yourself. And noticing when you're erring in either direction, noticing when you're getting too tense and through grasping, and noticing when you're getting too lax from being overly passive. The noticing is our guide. Noticing when what we're doing is not working, and then making a correction, adapting. It's a lot of what this practice is, just finding what isn't so skillful, isn't working so well, and then making an adjustment, and then making another lack of balance, and then correcting. And there's no substitute for doing the work oneself. No verbal instructions can compare to just going through the process. He continues, people may sleep on the same bed under the same covers, yet their individual dreams are not the same. An ancient sage said, we share the same one reality, yet do not realize it. For example, within the single reality of life and death, there are those who can enter into life and death without being bound by life and death, and there are those who are bound by life and death in the midst of life and death. In the midst of the same common reality, one person is bound while another is free. Is this not the individual differences in the dreams? You usually make birth and death into one extreme and absence of birth and death into another extreme. You make thinking into one extreme and non-thinking into another extreme. You make speech into one extreme and non-speech into another extreme. This is our basic problem, living in these dualities, and meaning living out of our thoughts, out of categories that seem to be binary. Here I have neither the business of Zen monks nor anything transcendental. I just talk about getting out of birth and death. This is not a matter of simply saying this and letting the matter rest at that. You must see that which has no birth or death right in the midst of birth and death. Birth and death, if that's hard to relate to, just think of change. It really means change. To see what is beyond change right in the midst of change. And change, that is, our changing conditions, starting with the weather, and the conditions of mind that fluctuate, conditions, circumstances, things that come down the pike that we aren't expecting, things that throw us. This is birth. This is what he means by birth and death, change. And how we can ride those waves of changing circumstances and conditions while maintaining this center that is beyond change. This, too, is the work of Sesshin. Everything we're doing in Sesshin is training for living. This isn't just some rarefied atmosphere that presents a certain unique set of challenges. It's all training. We're training here this week to be able to adapt to change, to move along with it, rather than fighting it. And it starts with just not getting caught in states of mind that we find ourselves in Sesshin. Learning experientially that these states pass, and that through concentration on the practice we're working on, they pass more quickly. That we don't get bogged down in them to the degree to which we remain true to our practice, the breath or the koan or whatever. Continues, the great master Yongjia visited the sixth patriarch of Zen and said, "The matter of birth and death is serious. Transitoriness is swift." The sixth patriarch said, "Why not comprehend the birthless and realize what has no speed?" Yongjia said, "Comprehension itself is birthless. Realization of the fundamental has no speed." There's a note here near the back of the book under the section of notes where the translator, in referring to this passage, he said, "Birth and death." And by the way, that's a translation of the Sanskrit word samsara. Birth and death refers to the continual varying and shifting of mental states, moods, and thoughts in the ordinary mind. Getting out of birth and death means stabilizing stabilizing the autonomous function of the directorate faculty of the essential mind, which is not emotionally influenced by the wavering of moods or the rise and fall of thoughts and ideas. This stability is what we develop by and by through long practice. We're not thrown by change, by thoughts and emotional states. The common simile is the ocean, where at the surface of the ocean you have all these waves, this commotion, ups and downs, but then underneath that is, relatively speaking, this stillness, this calm. He then now relates a dialogue. When Kaoshan took leave of Dongshan, Dongshan asked, "Where are you going?" Kaoshan replied, "To an unchanging place." Dongshan retorted, "If it is an unchanging place, how could there be any going?" Kaoshan replied, "The going is also unchanging." He says, "Were these not realized people? You make thought one extreme and non-thinking another extreme. You make the unspoken outside of the spoken. Even if you understand the unspoken clearly, as soon as words are spoken, they block you." In other words, he's just warning about this bifurcating mind, this dividing things. And things can only be divided through words and concepts. There are no divisions except in words and concepts. Without words and concepts, everything is just this one. Just this. This is, as we realize, is by transcending words and concepts, we experience this one that unites us all. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow
great endless blind passions I vowed above root Dharma gaze beyond measure I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha I vow to attain.